I'm so grateful for all the energy, time, and effort that all of our musicians put into leading us in worship each week. Thank you. It's not just on Sunday morning, but throughout the week that they work so hard to make this happen. So, somebody tell me, what is one of your all-time favorite popular songs? A song that really moves you. Tell me.
Oh, Happy Days.
Oh, Happy Days. That's a good choice, Geraldine. And why does that song move you so much? For those who are watching online, what Geraldine said is, I don't want Bambi to know, but I used to sing in the choir when I was a kid and got to do the lead in that song. But then as an adult, she started smoking and lost her voice. That's Geraldine's story. All right, somebody else. Everyday People. Amy says Everyday People. If I were to answer that question, I might say I Will Always Love You by Whitney Houston. Or, well, yes, Dolly sings it too. But I'm too young to remember that. I remember the another great one, Aretha Franklin, Respect. I mean, the vocal in that is just so powerful. I might even pick A Whiter Shade of Pale as rendered by Willie Nelson. And I know that's an odd choice, but I'm an odd guy. There's just something about the music, not even the lyrics in that song. When that music starts to play, I can't help but groove wherever I am. And I don't got much groove in me, let me tell you. But when that song starts playing, just the power of the music, what little groove I got, it starts to move me. Music is just so powerful. Edward Lighton says, music, once admitted to the soul, becomes a sort of spirit that never dies. You know, people that get Alzheimer's, usually the last thing they lose is their memory of key songs in their life. Matt Haig said, music doesn't get in, music is already in. Music simply uncovers what is already there, makes you feel emotions you didn't necessarily know you had inside you, and runs around waking them all up. Right now, we are in the midst of a sermon series based on the Old Testament book of Psalms, which is a compilation of some of the favorite songs of our ancestors in the faith. Music is a window on the soul, and so these psalms give us a window into the hopes and dreams, the fears and anxieties of our ancestors in the faith. And as we look through that window into the book of Psalms, we discover that the hopes, fears, dreams, and anxieties of our ancestors in the faith were remarkably similar to our own. And that means we can learn so much from their experience. Last week, we looked at Psalm 1, which addresses one of our deepest personal concerns. How can I thrive in life? Now today, we're going to look at Psalm 2, which addresses one of humanity collectively's deepest concerns. Namely, what's going to happen to life on planet Earth? Where is all of this headed? It's like last week we took a microscope and trained it deep on one of our greatest personal concerns, how can I thrive? And now it's like we're taking a telescope today and looking all around us at the context in which we live, and we find ourselves wondering, what's going to happen to all of this? Psalm 2 addresses that. Let's explore it today, starting with a prayer. God, we read about the epic events of history, the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, the rise and fall of ancient Israel, the rise and fall of fascism in Germany, Italy, Japan. We read about great things that have happened in history, the discovery of the printing press, penicillin, mass production, the emergence of powerful ideas like democracy and equality. We read about the bad things, global warming, resurgent authoritarianism, and the stubborn persistence of prejudice and tribalism. And we can't help but wonder, what's going to happen? Where is all this leading? Holy Spirit, you know the beginning from the end. Guide our thoughts today. Give us wisdom. Give us the right framework for understanding where we are and where all these things are going. We ask in the name of Jesus. Amen. So, I've got good news and I've got bad news today. Who wants to hear the bad news first? Raise your hand. A few, okay. Who wants to hear the good news first? Several. Actually, I want to hear the bad news first, and God and me are a majority. So let's start with the bad news, because that's where Psalm 2:1 begins. Psalm 2:1 says, "Why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers, the powers that be, take counsel together against the Lord and against the Lord's Messiah, saying, 'Let us burst their bonds asunder and cast their cords from us.'" You see what that's saying, right? From the beginning of time and throughout time, we, the human race, have been a rebellious lot. God created this garden-like world and planted us human beings here on earth to partner with God, to be God's people, to be God's representative, and share the love and the goodness of God with all of the earth. It's as if God said to us, "Let's do something beautiful together." And recurringly throughout the ages, collectively as humanity, our response to God has been, "Buzz off, God. You are not the boss of us. We'll do it our way." The Lord and the Lord's Messiah have said to us, "Let's do something beautiful together." And our collective response as a human race is, "Let us burst their bonds asunder and cast their cords from us." The cords of your love, God, will not constrain us. Your values will not bind us. Leave us alone. We'll do it our way. And oh, what a mess we've made. Oh, the things that we do to each other. A decade or so ago, I was reading an article one morning in the Indianapolis Star. It was telling about a time when the New England Patriots were coming to town to play the Indianapolis Colts at Lucas Oil Stadium. This was the day before the game when a local reporter was out and about town when he happened to notice a Colts fan who was standing in the middle of some railroad tracks in downtown Indianapolis and jumping up and down and shouting at the top of his lungs, "21! 21! 21! Before long, a guy wearing a Patriots shirt comes along, sees the Colts fan and what he's doing, and must have thought to himself, anything that a Colts fan can do, a Patriots fan can do better. And so the Patriots fan stands out in the middle of the railroad tracks, and he starts jumping up and down higher than the Colts fan and shouting louder than the Colts fan, "21! 21! 21! In fact, this Patriots fan gets so into it that he does not hear the freight train coming from behind him. And just before the freight train gets there, the Colts fan jumps off the tracks and the train splatters the Patriots fan. After the train passes, the Colts fan goes back out onto the track, starts jumping up and down again, now shouting, "22! 22! 22. It's a humorous story, and okay, it maybe didn't happen exactly that way, but, although, you know, the Patriots deserve it, right? biggest cheaters in the world. But anyway, a humorous story, but it points us to a deadly, serious problem with the human race. God says, love your enemies. And we say, hate the enemy. God says, blessed are the peacemakers. And we say, we'd rather make war. Buzz off, God. Leave us alone. We've got it from here. Almost 30 years ago now, I read an article in the New York Times, this time for real. And the article told the story of two women, Brenda and Wanda Henson, who had a dream. This story disturbed my soul so much, I've carried the memory of it ever since. So Brenda and Wanda, who were a couple, had a dream to establish a women's retreat center where women could come together and build friendships and do workshops and study important women's issues. And so they bought a farm deep in the pine forests of southern Mississippi, a few miles away from a town of 1,200 people called Ovid, Mississippi. And they started to put together this retreat center there. They called it Camp Sister Spirit. And it got off to a great start. They were hosting retreats and workshops and so on and so forth until word began to spread in four Baptist churches in and around Ovid that Camp Sister Spirit had set up on the outside of town. And those four churches started to rally their people to get this thing shut down and get these people out of here. Before long, the two women started getting threatening phone calls from some of these so-called good Christian people. One day they had a terrifying encounter with an armed man on their property. They had to put up security gates and recruit armed volunteers who would patrol the property to keep it safe. One day when Brenda was walking down their long driveway out to the mailbox to pick up the mail, as she approached the mailbox, she saw a horrifying sight. Somebody had slaughtered a puppy dog and draped it over the mailbox as a warning to these two women. Can you imagine slaughtering one of God's innocent creatures to scare somebody else? Brenda says, I had hoped to move my mom in with us. She's 89 years old, but she said, I'm afraid of what might happen to her. Brenda ended up being interviewed on the Oprah Winfrey Show because this started to make national news. The four churches held a big rally in the courthouse in Ovid. 400 people gathered to figure out what they were going to do about this thing. During that gathering, they showed some video clips from the Oprah interview of Brenda as Brenda explained how afraid she and Wanda and the others were, and they didn't know what they were going to do. And so she started to weep as she told the story of the dog that got slaughtered and put over their mailbox. And as she wept, the New York Times reporter that was at this meeting says, various people in the audience began to laugh and mock her. And after the meeting was over, as people were dispersing, a small crowd of them surrounded two men that they presumed to be gay and started shouting at them, sinners, queers. A police officer had to intervene to escort them to safety. As the Times reporter interviewed some of the participants in the rally, one of them said to the New York Times reporter, it's a sin the way they're living, and it's corrupting our community. We're a God-fearing community. Another one of these participants complained to the reporter that reporters were presenting them as bigots, and he went on to say, we don't want to hurt those people. I just think they need to pack their bags and go back to New York or California or wherever they came from. Where have we heard that before? Those people go back to where they came from. To me, that story captures in a nutshell just how broken our world is. What a mess we have made of this planet. Jesus, the Messiah, says, love your enemies. We say, hate the enemy. God the Father says there's more than enough for everybody, and we say, I want it all for me and my people. Jesus the Messiah says, blessed are the peacemakers. And we say, Jesus, tell that to the barrel of my gun. Let us burst their bands asunder and cast their cords from us. You are not the boss of us, and we end up with Uvalde and Tree of Life Synagogue and the Pulse. We end up with Ukraine. We end up with George Floyd and Trayvon Martin. We end up with women being oppressed in Iran. We end up with multitudes of people starving to death in Somalia and Yemen and Afghanistan. Sisters and brothers, we are in a world of hurt. Never underestimate the power of evil in this world. That's the bad news. But thankfully, Psalm 2 doesn't end there. Because the good news is, no matter how bad it gets down here, God will not be defeated. Psalm 2, verse 4. The one who sits in the heavens laughs. God finds it amusing that we puny humans would think that we can overthrow ultimately God's purposes. The one who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord has them in derision. The Lord will speak to them in wrath and terrify them in fury, saying, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. That's a reference to the Messiah. And then in the passage, God speaks directly to the Messiah. Verse 7, saying, you are my son. Today I've begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. In other words, this Messiah will reign over all the earth. You shall break evildoers with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. So that, yes, we look around us and we see the mess. Yes, everywhere we look around us, we see evidence of the power of evil. Hate is strong, evil is great, and it can feel so overwhelming sometimes. But the promise of Psalm 2 is that no matter how bad it gets down here, ultimately love wins. There's coming a day when the love and the goodness of Jesus Christ will spread out across this earth and reign supreme. Jeff, you may say, the way it's described here in Psalm 2, it sounds kind of violent. Break them with a rod of iron. Dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Would Jesus really be that violent? Well, think about it this way. In the book of Revelation, we're told that Jesus' weapon of choice is a sword that comes from his mouth. Now, think about what that means. Jesus' weapon of choice is not a conventional sword you hold in your hand, a blunt instrument of force, but a sword that comes from his mouth. Elsewhere, the Bible says that God's truth, God's word, is sharper than a two-edged sword, cutting right through lies and violence and prejudice. Put those two things together, that Jesus' weapon of choice is a sword that comes from his mouth, not a literal sword, that truth is sharper than a two-edged sword. And what that means is, the only weapon Jesus will use to ultimately overcome the evil in this world is the power of truth. The beauty, the compelling power of the words that he shares with us. And the promise of Psalm 2 is that a day is coming when that truth and that goodness and that beauty will spread out across the earth and reign supreme over us. But that, of course, leads to an obvious next question. How will we ever get from where we are now to that day of promise? There are a lot of prophetic passages in the Bible that talk about that. And guess what? This will come as no surprise to you. There is a lot of disagreement about what those prophetic passages mean. There are primarily four different schools of thought about how the end of the age will unfold. And each of those four schools has a complicated theological name. Each of those four schools takes all of these prophetic passages seriously and parses them carefully and in good faith comes up with an interpretation. And we could really get in the weeds on that today. We don't need to. For present purposes, all we need to know is that of those four leading schools of thought about how the end of the age will occur, two of those schools of thought take a pessimistic interpretation. Two of those schools of thought look at the prophetic passages and reach the conclusion that here on planet Earth, things are just going to keep getting gradually worse and worse and worse until we ultimately find ourselves in such a time of great tribulation that Jesus will have no choice but to come back, intervene, and establish the messianic reign. The other thing you need to know, for present purposes, is that the other two interpretations, you guessed it, take an optimistic perspective, parse all of those same prophetic scriptures, and reach a diametrically different conclusion, saying that Earth will eventually, gradually, get better and better. And the love and the goodness of Jesus and his message will spread wider and wider, creating a natural segue for Jesus to ultimately launch his messianic reign. So, four schools of thought, two pessimistic, two optimistic, completely different in that regard. Both agree we reach the same endpoint, but by very different paths, and that leaves us wondering which one is right. The answer, if somebody's going to be honest, is we don't know. Nobody knows. Jesus Christ himself said in Matthew 24, 36, when speaking about the end of the age, Jesus himself said about that day and hour, say it with me, no one knows. Neither the angels in heaven nor who? The Son. That's Jesus. But only the Father in heaven. So Jesus Christ told us, when it comes to these end of the age prophecies, you're not going to figure them out. Jesus said that even he, while he was here on earth, had relinquished that knowledge, leaving it with God in heaven. So what do we Christians do? We come up with these elaborate and detailed schemes about how the end times will happen, and that's perfectly fine. But then we go on to say that the scheme that my church, that my denomination came up with, is the right one and everybody else is wrong. Even though Jesus said, nobody knows. Oh, for heaven's sakes, what is wrong with us? But Jeff, you may say, okay, so if God knew in advance that God was going to give us all of these prophetic prophecies and we weren't going to be able to figure them out, what's the point? Why did God give us those prophecies? Here's a thought. Maybe, just maybe, God gave us those prophecies, not so we could figure them out, but so those prophecies would create in us an awareness, an alertness, that what now is will not always be. That a change is a coming. Maybe God gave us all of these deliberately vague prophecies that we're not going to be able to figure out simply to give us the confidence that however they play out, they will lead to an endpoint that is beautiful and hopeful, the messianic reign, and we can now live with that hope in our hearts. And here's another one, maybe the most important one. Maybe, just maybe, God gave us these prophecies with symbols and things that are so vague they can be interpreted as pessimistic or maybe God gave us those deliberately vague prophecies because God made a sovereign decision to fix the end point of human history, the messianic reign, the goodness of God wins and prevails, but between here and there, to give us human beings a zone of freedom so that we're not robots, we're not automatons, we're not simply playing out a script that's already been written and we have no choice. Maybe God said, humanity, here's the end point. How you get there is up to you. You can get there in a beautiful and wonderful way, or you can get there in a perilous and tragic way, depending on the choices that you make collectively. Have you ever heard of one of those movies where you're like two-thirds of the way through the movie and the movie pauses and allows you, the viewer, to decide whether you want to see the happy ending to the story or the tragic ending to the story? What if the biblical prophecies are kind of like that? Here are these prophecies, and they can be interpreted as being a perilous path to the end or a beautiful path to the end. And which path is chosen depends upon us collectively and the choices we make. Personally, that's what I believe. It's up to us. We're in a zone of freedom. And that means what we do individually and collectively matters. Our choices have real consequences. Once upon a time, there was a holy man who was in a deep trance and said, God, I want to better understand what heaven and hell are like. And so God led the holy man to two great doors. God opened the first door and allowed the holy man to look into the first room. The holy man saw in that room there was this huge round table and people sitting all around the table. And sitting in the middle of that table was a huge pot of stew that smelled so heavenly it made the holy man's mouth water. Despite this incredible pot of stew in the middle of the table, the people around it, the people that were sitting around the table were thin, emaciated, and starving to death. Because you see, they had spoons that had such long handles, they could dip their spoon into the stew but could not get it back to their mouth. The holy man shuddered at the sight of this great suffering, and God said, hell is kind of like that. Then God led the holy man to a second great door. The door swung open. The holy man looked in and was startled to see it was the same thing. Big round table. People sitting all around the table. Big pot of savory stew in the middle. The people around the table had the same incredibly long spoons that could not be gotten back to their mouths. And yet in this room, the people were full and satisfied, well-nourished, happy, and laughing. God says to the holy man, heaven is kind of like this. The holy man says, God, I don't understand. What makes the difference? God says, it's simple. The people in the second room have figured out how to feed each other. I dip the long spoon into the big pot of stew. I can't feed myself, but I can feed you. And you dip your long spoon in, and you can feed me. And sharing, there's more than enough. What if the biblical prophecies are kind of like those two rooms? Same context, same circumstances and potential, but very different outcomes depending upon the choices that we make. If enough of us do our part, maybe Earth can make its way to its end point of the messianic reign along a beautiful and loving path. But if enough of us don't do our part, maybe we'll have to make our way to that glorious end point on a perilous and tragic path. It's up to us. What we do matters. here's a practical example of how all this works. You may recall that, about 3 months ago now, I told you the story of a great pastor, a great prophet who has an incredible ministry in Africa. His name is Philip Stargate. Philip has formed an organization there called Crossing Lines Africa. And the mission of Crossing Lines Africa, the way I would put it is, he has a vision for creating churches in Africa like Life Journey Church. Churches that embrace the gospel of peace and are inclusive and welcoming, practicing grace, theologically open-minded. Because you see, as you probably know, on the continent of Africa, the predominant form of, quote, Christianity is a very virulent, dogmatic, harsh, exclusive form of Christianity that causes, frankly, a lot of suffering and pain, not unlike those Baptist churches in the New York Times article that I mentioned. And so Crossing Lines Africa, its mission is to identify churches that want to grow into the gospel of peace, want to be welcoming, inclusive spaces. And the goal of Crossing Lines Africa is to equip them and to teach them and to help evolve them and to network them together. And so Philip and others with him travel across the African continent, and they do workshops and teach, and they give resources and communication lines. And as part of that teaching I mentioned a few months ago, a group around Philip has translated our church's book on homosexuality in the Bible, The Children Are Free, and use that as a key teaching resource, because they're teaching these African churches to be affirming, welcoming of LGBTQ+ people. And believe me, this is a dangerous and controversial ministry, but think of the potential. Imagine an Africa full of churches that embrace the gospel of peace someday. Change the continent of Africa, and the continent of Africa can help change the world. So this is a powerful ministry that we partner in with Philip Stargate by providing financial support and prayer support. And when I told you about this a few months ago, I told you that Philip was just launching a 17-nation tour through the south and east of Africa, stopping at churches along the way, teaching, encouraging, exhorting. I mean, he's a real apostle and prophet in our time. And halfway through that journey, as it turns out, as Philip was riding a motorbike through a wilderness area out of Namibia and into South Africa to the next church he was due to stop at, as fate would have it, a small animal ran out in front of him. He lost control of his bike, went toppling to the ground in a crash, and broke his spine in multiple places. Laying there on the ground, immobile, thankfully someone came along. He was transported to a hospital and ultimately transported back to his home in Uganda, but in traction, flat on his back, warned by the doctors, if you move the wrong way, you could become paralyzed for the rest of your life. He needed sophisticated surgery to put his spine back together again and to be whole-bodied again. But that kind of sophisticated surgery in Africa costs about $6,000. Now, in America, that would be a bargain basement price. But in Africa, $6,000 is huge. Philip's family, like most families in Africa, have no medical insurance. In fact, he doesn't even take a salary from Crossing Lines Africa. He supports his family through a small farm that they have. And so here he ends up in traction, immobilized, needing a surgery that he cannot possibly afford, that Crossing Lines Africa cannot possibly afford. And so we, Life Journey Church, had to make a choice. So our elected representatives, our board of directors, gathered together. We shared the information with them. They discussed it. They asked questions. They investigated. Dr. Tara even took a look at the images from Philip's injury, and ultimately our board of directors decided we can't let a ministry that has so much potential, a prophet that has so much potential, we can't let that ministry die because of this kind of an injury. And so We haven't budgeted for that $6,000, and that $6,000 is a big chunk out of our budget. But our board of directors decided this was a time to take a step of faith. And so this church has completely underwritten that surgery for Philip Stargate. The surgery has now been completed, and it was successful. Philip is still going through a grueling process of physical rehab, but the prognosis is that he'll be able to return to full activity and to full ministry. To me, that story is an excellent example of the power of the choices that we make individually and collectively to shape the future. Also, to me, that story is a powerful example of why the stewardship drive that we're doing right now here at Life Journey Church matters so much. I shared with you last week how right now, on a weekly average basis, our offerings are running $1,280 short of our budget, and that if that gap were to continue, we would have to significantly dial back on some of our activities. But God still has big things for this church to do. If enough of us, like the people in that vision of that holy man, if enough of us pull a seat up to the table and share, if enough of us are generous, whatever that generosity looks like for each of us in our individual financial circumstances, we can close that gap and we can continue doing great world-impacting things together. This church can make a difference. Every regular giver to this church played a part in helping that surgery happen for Philip and in saving the ministry of this incredible prophet in Africa. That's the power of our collective action. Jesus said in Matthew 10:41, whoever blesses a prophet as a prophet will receive a prophet's reward. In other words, someday in heaven, each regular giver to this church will, in the eyes of God, share credit for the accomplishments of Philip Stargate and Crossing Lines Africa, because we're partnering with them. We're doing this together. That is the power of our collective action. If you're not yet a regular giver to this church, but you're excited about what God is doing through this church and what God will do through this church, would you please consider becoming a regular giver at any level? And those of us who are already regular givers, would you please consider whether you're at a place in life where you could increase that giving by any amount? The response form is attached to the Sunday headlines this morning, and also that same response form can be found online on the links page under the heading stewardship form. If enough of us pull up a seat at the table and share, there will be more than enough. Giving is such an important part of our discipleship because our money is powerful and can help change the world. But it's not just about giving, because the truth is every single practical choice we make in every situation in life is either moving us closer to heaven and bringing us closer to the messianic reign, to the time when the values and love and grace of Jesus will flood the earth, or bringing us closer to a perilous path that is pushing us away from that messianic reign. Every choice we make makes a difference. Let me close with this. It's one of my favorite stories about Pastor David. And I'm partial, of course, but I often see the love of God flowing through David in amazing ways. And so this is one of my favorite David stories. This was, years ago now, but David was coming home from church. It was a dark, rainy, and cold night. He was about 2 miles away from our home on a two-lane county road when a cat suddenly darted out in front of an oncoming vehicle. The vehicle hit the cat and then drove on as if nothing had happened. David hit the brakes, pulled over, turned on his flashers, backed up, and positioned his vehicle so that nobody else would run over the cat because the cat was still in the road. Then he jumped out of his vehicle and quickly realized that the cat was too badly wounded. She wasn't going to make it. I said to David, "Well, what did you do?" He said, "Well, I sat down there on the road next to her, and I talked to her because I didn't want her to be alone when she breathed her last." So there he is, sitting in the cold rain on the cold pavement, talking to one of the smallest of God's creatures, because he didn't want her to be alone in her last moments. That is the beauty of Jesus Christ. That is the way of Jesus. Someday, the day is coming when the goodness and the love of Jesus Christ will spread out across this globe and fill every nook and cranny and reign supreme over planet Earth. The only open question is, how will we get there? Collectively, by the decisions we make, if enough of us do our part, maybe we'll be able to get there the beautiful, loving way. Or, if enough of us don't do our part, maybe we'll have to get there the perilous and treacherous way. It's up to us. What we do matters. So let's go out of here and let's renew our determination to let our light shine. Let's renew our determination to be the salt of the earth. Because how we get from here to there is up to us. What we do matters.